moving like that. Is that okay?
Yep.
Can you just, that's not going to drop, is it? I'm very good at dropping microphones. It's absolutely fabulous to be here in the coldest room in the history of poetry, where we'll all be found completely rigid, uncovered by archaeologists who will wonder what was going on with all these pens and things. It's my first time in Ireland proper. The last time I was on the island of Ireland was in Belfast in 1981, when Bobby Sands was on hunger strike. It was an interesting place to be if you're English, and it was also a place where you learned not to talk, if possible. So there's that business of not being quite sure where you are. And then being in a place where you're warned what you mustn't call things, which is, when you think what poetry is about exactly naming what is what. And to go to the province, Northern Ireland, whatever you called it, was going to cause offence to somebody. So you try to say, they say, oh, it's really like, I really like here. And you stick at that. What do you call it? I didn't have any words, so I just spent all the time being frightened in silence instead. But there were sadder things. And there was a great long-distance walker called John Hillaby. And he wrote a book about walking Land's End to Johnny Groats in the 60s. That was his first long walk. And he was up in the Highlands, up in Knoydart somewhere, and lost. And he looked at his Ordnance Survey map, and he found exactly where he was, his compass bearings there. He knew where he was, and it said where he was. There was a name on the map, and the word was Larrack. He said, here you are, you're in Larrack, which is, and so it became the name of this pamphlet. What does it mean? It's Gaelic, and it means a place. It doesn't help you to find where you are, where you've come from, why you are. All it does is suggest that at some time somebody did something here, but nobody can quite remember what it was. There isn't a sadder word in the whole language, in the whole Scots Gaelic language. There's no sadder name. It's a name of dispossession, Larrack. So here's a poem for that one. Larrack, on OS maps, the Gaelic for a place that isn't anymore, the memory of a place like that road in Spain, a hot night wind, the churring of cicadas, cactus, salt in the air, and that little white-haired place somewhere in the borders, prim and discreet as a coffin, a chapel, cut down oil drum drinking troughs in roadside dust, goat bells, olives, stone, that place. And where the stag stood in the yellow of the headlight and the dark swirl of blown snow, there. Or one grey dawn where a flurry of buzzards flapped off the sop of a sheep in the turf cut. Larrack, of Pibroch, for places passed by, passed over, for the ache of forgetting, or for not forgetting. I thought we should start melancholic and work downwards from there, through kind of nihilism to existential despair and suicidal despondency. But we've got to get off somewhere, so... And when you have to set off, you need advice, and folk tales understand this. The beginnings of folk tales are all the same. So this is the title poem from the next small collection. It's called Advice to a Traveller. It's pointless to pack. If you must take a loaf, you'll find what you need as you go. Disregard nothing, a needle, a handkerchief, a comb, a pinch of salt, a flask of oil. You are the youngest of three. Wait until the other two have left. They will be well provisioned and well shod, and then you can go. Listen to all you meet. They will give you wishes. Go with a clear heart. Do not be surprised when your bread stays the hunger of wolves. The comb cast down becomes a thicket of thorn, the handkerchief a lake, when oil unseals the iron gates and salt seasons the banquet of a king. All will be well if you're in the right story. We become voyagers, and there's quite a few poems coming up which have to do with my fascination with the Norsemen, the Vikings, call them what you will. So I think it's quite appropriate. I haven't quite understood the history of Cork, but Paul filled me in on that, and I thought, good, I've got all these, and I'd already planned it's just an accident, which is nice. My Norsemen are associated particularly with the northeast coast of England, Northumbria, which is the coast of St Cuthbert and the Farne Islands and the Lindisfarne Gospels and also Hilda of Whitby. So it's all that stuff, but I'm going to take a trip to Skye and then whip back to Northumberland again. So coasting. We come out of the north, from the fjords, from the coral beaches of Orkney, the stones of Callanish, riding the Whale Road south to Dunstanburgh, its white sand, the lifting waves, the drifts of gulls, threading the ferns and their rocks, and all their names in languages we cannot pronounce or understand, hearing the chop of the boat, the slop of the bilges, scenting the rack of the shore in the tallow reek of the sail, rowing the heft and weight of it like levering great stones from sucking ground. Let us come quiet as we may to land, let the wind be kind. Let us come surprising as hail out of an empty sky. Let us come under a scud of cloud to the pale shore, to the dunes, to the marin grass. Let the tooth of the boar on the dark stone be broken. Let there be gold. Let the little men run from their houses. Let there be thatch to burn. Let there be women to take. Let the wind not turn. The last point, of course, is if the wind turned and you were caught on the shore and the Anglo-Saxon peasants who ran away suddenly saw that, then they stopped running and they came back, and you were likely as a Norseman to be flayed alive and nailed on the church door. So you didn't want the wind to turn. You didn't want to lay shore. The Norsemen, of course, in addition to that, they came to Ireland and they came to the outer islands of Scotland. One of my favourite places in the world is the Isle of Skye, where I've been going every year for 30 odd years. And there's one particular mountain in the Red Cullen behind Broadford on Skye. And the first thing you see from the bridge, you see there's this kind of little pimple on top, and it's a cairn. Huge cairn, it's about 50 paces round, and it's supposed to be the burial of a Norwegian princess of the 9th century who was known as Mad Mary or Saucy Mary, who anticipated Margaret Thatcher and her bridge by drawing a chain across the Kyle so the boats could not get across, they had to pay a toll. So they're a bit kind of ambivalent about Saucy Mary on there. But there she is, buried on top of this mountain, 3,000 feet up, by Vikings. And there's a treasure buried there. And the hill is Ben na Cailleach, which means the hill of the old woman. Ben na Cailleach, because they had mastery of iron, because the land was thin and hard, because the sea was the way to everything, because nothing could gainsay a well-caught, lap-straight boat with a flare at the bow that perfectly fit a space the water would make for it, because their oceans were swan's paths, whale roads, because they wrote their maps in the wind, in the run of the cod, of the herring, of the cloud, the way that gulls would go, because of that they sailed out from granite fjords, cargoed with amber and jet and beaver pelt, red river gold and wolf skins, over the Dogger, the mouth of the Rhine, round Cape Wrath to the Irish Sea, Biscay, the gates of the Mediterranean, its hot shores, its painted boats, and white-sailed dhows as bright as ghosts, and all for the lapis, amethyst, white gold that they spun into knotwork dragons, swallowing their tails, bracelets, cloak pins, breast pins, clasps and rings. Who counted the hours of tillage, the scantlings of barley and oats, the frozen sleet on longship shrouds, skin torn on intractable nets, or how many million herring and cod shrank in the wind on the racks of spruce? Who told how it was, after all the work of hands and years, they could fashion chests out of black bog oak, bind them with iron strips, lock up the lapis, the gold, the bright enamel, and bury them high in the eye of the wind on a red granite summit over snowfield and scree in a grave with a princess anointed and shrouded, how they might raise a great cairn with chalkstone and boulder, and no one would touch it. And nobody has. Nobody's dug it up. So that's kind of legendary stuff, but the strange things happen. This is about an encounter I had on the Slate Peninsula of Skye, where I stay and where I go for short walks, and met these two cockle-picking women. Effie, the shepherd's wife who rents me the house, she said, "Oh, yon tinkers." And I said, "You're not supposed to call them tinkers now." She says, "Oh, I know that, but they are." So at Tarskevay. So what we've got? We've got Irish women and a tourist, me, and Selkies. You've got to have Selkies. They're very fashionable in poetry now, have you noticed? Feminist poetry particularly, you've got to have Selkies. You know what Selkies are? Seal women. That's half man, half seal, half woman, half seal. Wonderful. At Tasker Bay, which is the Bay of Cod. At Tasker Bay. Washed up on a rug shoreline with floats, fish boxes, trawlermen's gloves, fertiliser sacks, kelp, clots of wool, the cockle pickers. Peat cured with ruined teeth, long dirty nails, eyes as dark as iodine. They tinkers. "Oh," says Effie, "you do well to look to the burdens and count the spades. And what did they ask you for, those women? Old belts, old coats belted with rope, rubber boots patched with gaffer tape, hair like seaweed when they tapped on the windscreen, brown as silkies. And for a light only, the bright ember, blue smoke blown on the wind, the spit of rain off the sea, and thanks we're away, and down the road, and done with the day, with turning stones and bladderwrack, browsing the cold shore for cockles to fill a knuckly net, iron, amber, cobalt, rust. What's to be done with Tarskevay tinkers who come up out of the peat or the sea, and when the light goes, where do they turn? Can they drift off? I've no idea where they go at night. They worry me. I dream about them. Part of me wants to ask them in the room, and the other part, the bigger part, says no. I don't think so. So there's what says a flavour of the landscapes and stories and language that bleed into so many poems that I write. which is odd because I come from a small, quiet, inland woolen mill town. It's, you know, it's right in the middle, it's not near the sea. And maybe that's why I'm fascinated by the sea. And they certainly feed into this one, which is, to me, it's about poetry, it's about the writing of poetry and why poetry is. But before I start, you need to know that there's a character in here is Väinämöinen. Väinämöinen is the hero of the Finnish Kalevala. He's the Prometheus figure who wins fire for mankind. Oh, and St. Cuthbert turns up here, and so do Native Americans. So here we go, for the true naming of the world. And I thought, what serendipity, you've got this 5-word challenge, yes? This was written in under 5 minutes, and it's hardly been changed. And Anne Sampson at a poetry business workshop, for which you would pay £30 for a full day, and you can come in here and get it for nothing. Right? And I was trying to remember what the 5 words were. One was some kind of hero. It wasn't exactly words and phrases. Some kind of hero, some kind of headgear, the name of a county, blah, 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 blah. Can't remember the other thing, but you get the idea. So, and it's a bump, and off it went. For the true naming of the world, you need one who will recognize a fish that has swallowed a star that fell through the vaults of the air. One who wears a helmet or bears a sword forged in the heart of mountains from metals whose names no man ever knew. To bear a name that cannot be forgot, a name to fit in a verse to be sung at a feast. You need one to be sent on a quest through silent forests, stony wastes, to a bony church and a hillside that opens to a way that he'll walk through all the ages to come, dumb and dazzled to the seashore under huge lucid skies, into the wind to build monasteries, to illuminate gospels, to speak to otters, spear the sea like a gannet, to be one with wind and with seals. And then stones and flowers might come to know themselves. Day's Eye, Comfrey, Coltsfoot, Mallow, Vetch, Stonecrop, Feverfew, and Hornblende, Granite, Wolfram, Flint and Gneiss. Valleys might come to know their depths, and becks and burns to know the purposes of rain and the ways of the clough and the gorge under blood moons, hair moons, the moon when horns are broken. Then, and I'll finish off with this kind of Northumbrian, kind of incantatory stuff, which is about my love of a particular story from Anglo-Saxon literature, which you know about, I think it's Bede or Cadman, but it's the parable of the life of man is like the flight of a sparrow that flies into the mead hall just for a moment and out. And it sounds dire, but I don't think it is. So, in the meantime, this was actually a 3-word prompt, the first task of a morning in a workshop. In the meantime, off you go, so here it is. In the meantime, because that's how it is, the sparrow flying into the mead hall, bewildered by smoke reek, gusts of beer breath, out of the wild dark and into the half light of embers, sweat, the steam of fermenting rushes, and maybe a harp and an epic that means nothing in a language it doesn't know, this sparrow, frantic to be out there, and maybe it perches on a tarry roof beam, catches a wingtip, comes up against thatch like a moth on a curtain, and it beats its wings, it beats its wings, it tastes a wind with the scent of rain, the thin smell of snow, of stars, and somehow it's out into the turbulence of everywhere, and who knows what happens next. And I think the wonderful thing about that metaphor that's not intended is, who knows what happens next? The sparrow's out of it, it's come out of the dark. I think that's wonderful. I think it gives me huge optimism. So it's a bird, and I'm watching the term carefully. When I'm down to my last two, shout.
Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So make sure, because I could go on too early. I'll do Ken Dodd. Nobody's going. When I put this collection together, I discovered to my horror, I've written loads and loads of poems about birds. And curiously, I'm not very interested in birds. I don't know a lot about birds. My father was a bird watcher. He knew everything about him. And as a result, I know nothing because I didn't want anything to do with it. The other thing about these birds is they're all dead. And I thought, every bird I've written about is dead. And I think it started with this. This was a... Of course, I was on in Whitby, and a guy brought a dead goldcrest in. It had flown into the window. This was in December time and killed itself. The goldcrest is a beautiful bird. It's the smallest British bird, smaller than the wren. And it's I love the wren dearly, but the goldcrest is something else. And I just held it in my hand, and it was just, oh, goldcrest. Unaccountably dead. This morning, being clear as gin, rain-soaked lawns brushed to a nap in the night, blackthorn and hornbeam newly wired, plugged in, switched on, and all a buzz. Why choose such a morning to be dead in? November staining windows ruby, amber, lime, and here you are cupped in a palm, too perfectly assembled, too compact ever to have flown, a soft, plump brooch, every feather trim, unruffled, green and gold as barley in a breeze, every bit of you pin sharp, smart as sixpence. There's nothing to be done. You can't stay here. Too much bird of you to stay indoors, too much sharp inquiry in each small, dark, aye. So that's for that'll do for all the birds, all the dead birds in that collection. That's my favourite dead bird. There are others, but we won't do that. But I thought, see if I can shift it a bit. I used to be awfully fond of a small collection of Ted Hughes, not poetry, that I used to read to my kids when they were tiny. And also, I'd read them to kids in primary schools that I worked in. And the collection of stories of Ted Hughes is called How the Whale Became. Do you know How the Whale Became? Oh, you must know. You've got to read How the Whale Became and other stories. Fabulous. Creation stories. So this is kind of thanks to Ted Hughes. When God made Heron, he wasn't thinking clearly. Let's see, says God, a bird that can spear a fish. I like that. Yeah. Let's give him a right long sharp beak, embellish it with gold. Nice touch. Not the fish of the oceans, though, thinks God, who'd spent the day before in a frenzy of creation, puffins, gannets, fulmars, skua. No, the fish of streams. Give him long thin legs, wide balancing feet. He'll need to be a hefty bird with legs that long, thinks God. My words, the wings he'll need, and a sharp dark eye. Wherever will he make his home? It had been a long day. He'll nest in a tree like all the rest, says God. Heron spread his wings and flew, landed in the thin high branches like a broken kite, like a thin old man falling off a bicycle. I say that I used to work in a place that had a heronry down the field. There's nothing more beautiful than watching a heron in flight, and nothing more sinister than a heron fishing just stood there. But a heron landing in a tree is just a bloody joke, isn't it? We should teach you. This is for the vegetarians. I thought we ought to have something kind of humorous. If it is, I'm not sure. The biggest producer of One Day Old Chicks in England in the 1960s was Todmorden up in the Calder Valley, just above where Ted Hughes comes from. Nobody knows why, but there it was. And all and if you're a One Day Old Chick producer, you need to determine which is a boy chick and which is a girl chick, yes? And the very best people at doing that, machines won't do it, but the very best practitioners of this are Japanese women. So there's this bunch of Japanese women living up on the Pennines in Todmorden, sexing tiny chickens. This is called Don't Count Your Chickens, for the last one-day-old chick producer in Todmorden. There's no profit in a one-day-old chick that can't one day lay eggs. Potential cockerels can't be used for anything. The most skilled one-day-old chick sexers are Japanese, whose fingers, tuned to flower arranging or origami, can in nanoseconds pick a one-day chick from a cheeping yellow queue of fluff that's slowly moving past on a carefully tuned and calibrated conveyor belt, determine if it's a girl, in which case deftly move it to a second belt that's destined for a shed where they are safely tucked in cardboard trays and sold in bulk, or if it's a boy, drop it dexterously in a 50-gallon blue plastic drum, and at the end of each 8-hour shift the drum is full and quiet and still. Next day they clock on again, sure as eggs is eggs. So when you're thinking about your cheap Kentucky Fried Chicken, think of all those little boys suffocating in a drum, and think again. I think it's enough to turn you vegetarian, said the man who's just had a bloody great big burger for his tea. Still, how are we doing? Just watching the time. I'm going to do a shift. I did a whole sequence of poems that started off with, which were giving dramatic monologues, if you like. I just wanted to put people in poems. All I wrote was landscapes. And the first way in was this kind of dramatic monologue. And I envisaged that famous statues were inhabited by the souls of the damned, that they were fallen angels. Obviously, the idea came from the Angel of the North, right? And then I thought, why not more of them? So transgressive, sinful people condemned to live inside these statues for one reason or another, and it shifted. And I gradually got very happy inhabiting other people's modes of thinking. This one, Billy Collins liked this one, and I thought, well, if Billy Collins likes it, it's all right then, so I'll do it. And it's called A Proper Job. And the workshop test, I write everything in workshops. I've got no spontaneity, I've got an original idea in my head, copy from everybody, but the task was, think of somebody who does an unusual job training somebody to do it. A proper job. It's a Yorkshire accent. It has to be Yorkshire. Proper job. Now then, there's more to this than people think. So listen. See, you want to get the build-up right. That one I took you to last week, all wrong. What's the good of flogging a chap till he can't carry the thing? He only ends up dropping it. Spectators want to help, military jump in, a bloody circus. Take my advice, you want to keep them fit and fed and fresh. They'll not thank you, but just think on, you're not there to cheer them up, just to do a proper job. Now, make sure you order oak that's been let to lie a year or two, and you'll need to cut a solid 6x6, one tight lap joint, nice and snug, 4 clean dowels, olive. Don't get palmed off with pine, because if it does get dropped, you don't want that cross piece twisted, because it causes too much bother later on. Nails? Oh, get them from that blacksmith by the market. You want clean cut, well tapered, a good 9-inch. And plan to use just the 3, but buy 6, because they can break if you don't catch them right. And anyway, a big lad might need 2 in each wrist. I'll tell you about the way to lie them down, the knots and the bones to get between, and the oisting and the dropping in the slot when we've had a snap. But just one thing, you get it right. You don't want another carry-on like that last week. The one it turned out wasn't dead. Never hear the last of that. I was taken to task by some very devout Christian over that, and I said, I didn't mean any wrong by it, missus. So, that's a relief. Another one of my heroes. U.A. Fanthorpe wrote about Richard III. I discovered we both have a soft spot for him. But thankfully, I wrote this poem before I read hers, so for that. Richard III, a man created as the villain that he never was, because the people who write history are the winners. By God, the Irish should know about that, shouldn't they? And the Scots, and everybody else. And the working class, and generally, so. Richard. This is Richard before Bosworth. Another Yorkshireman. Boy, there's no need for you to stay. I can fettle all this gear. The rest are all fucked off. You can go if you've a mind. There's no one will blame you. I shan't. But I'll tell you this. By God, I stand here, your rightful and anointed king, blessed by three suns rising in the smoking frost that day that Edward died, and the Lord did grant to us that failed. Well, go on, bustle then, make yourself useful. Buckle this shoulder brace. Oh, and pull this strap tight. I don't look surprised. What did you expect? A hump like a fucking minotaur? Just a wasted leg, a lurching gait. I'm not exactly the bottled spider, am I? Listen, your age, I was riding chargers, these slick-tongued pretty boys. I'll tell you what, I'll not burn in hell for that fat horse and Clarence, drowned in a butt of Malmsey, the fuck he did. Drank himself to death, God rot him. Oh, and I had their women. Well, of course I did, so would you. The Lady Anne, oh yes, spat right in my face, she did. I give it time. You can forget that tale about me wooing her across her husband's coffin. I just waited a day or two. Don't look like that. A sweet armful, Anne. She said I made her laugh. There's more ways than one to skin a cat. Do I see ghosts round every corner, boy? Kill enough and so will you. And don't think I lose a minute's sleep, all my family butchered. I can't smell blood these days. Right, you've done a grand job on these greaves. Light a candle for me if I don't come back. Get yourself to York and light it there. Give me my sword. By God's grace, I am England's king. So, let us go to it. Pray for me. And what did they do, Henry VII's bloody mercenaries? They killed my good King Richard. The citizens of York wrote in the city records, this day was our good King Richard most grievously murdered and slain. He wasn't a monster. They had to write him a monster though, didn't they? How are we doing for time?
Two more,
right, we'll do Bleak then. We'll do Bleak and then kind of crazy. There's a whole sequence leads up to the fact that as a recovering alcoholic, I'm very conscious of the idea of obsessiveness and also the lies that obsessive people tell, which led me to, I conceive a great hatred for the explorers like Shackleton and Scott, who serially promised their wives, no, I won't do it again, I won't do it again, I won't do it again. And Mallory, the Everest mountaineer, who just lied and lied and lied to his wife. But Mallory particularly, because he's associated with high places, with furling. I had to give up rock climbing because of vertigo. And it all comes together, the story of Icarus. You think of the great stories of furling. Lucifer, Hephaestus, thrown from heaven by his mother. Yeah, Icarus. So this falling. 24 years ago, one of my sons committed suicide. He went up to the top floor of a tower block in Leeds and he broke a window and jumped out. Nobody knows why. And it was maybe 21 years before I could write about it. And I wrote about it through the story of Icarus Festus. But the one that mattered was one kid more, who's red here. She got me to write this, and it just came out. It's called A Weak Force for Our David. A Weak Force. There's sometimes a loss you can't imagine, the lives never lived by your children, or by the one who simply stopped in the time it takes to fall to the ground from the top of a tower block. They say gravity is a weak force. I say the moon will tug a trillion tons of salt sea from its shore. I say a mountain range will pull a snowmelt puddle out of shape. I say gravity can draw a boy through a window and into the air. There's loss no one can imagine. In the no time between falling and not falling, you learned the art of not falling. Beneath you burned the lights of Sheepska, Hare Hills, Brigate, Vicar Lane. Lights shone in the glass arcades, on the tiles, on the gantries of toll trains. Motorway lights trailed ribbons of red. And you were far beyond falling, because you shut your eyes, because you always shut your eyes. You closed them tight as cockle shells, because when you did that, the world would go away, the world would not see you. And I remember how you ran like a dream. I remember how you laughed when I swore I would catch you. And then you flared. You went out. You flared like a moth and you blew away over the lights, over the canal, the river, the sour moors, the cotton grass, the mills of the plain, and over the sea, and over the sea, and the bright west, and you sank like the sun. And I felt guilty as I was blaming Leeds for this. I wrote a whole sequence of Leeds poems, Leeds people, but it was very nice about Leeds. I'll finish on this, it's a Leeds poem. And I have no idea where it came. It came from a simple prompt for a working exercise. And the prompt was, all over the city, word goes round. That's it. All over the city, word goes round, there'll be a dole of bread at St. Anne's Gates. You want to get down there? They're making a film of the revelation of St. John the Divine at the library. Johnny Depp and Kate Blanchett are in it. The word goes round. They've caught the supermarket poisoner. They've caught him. They're bringing him up Albion Street. You want to get down there? It's right. And three virgins all in green are dancing on the air at the armories below the weirs. The wither's gone a sapphire blue and salmon are leaping and nobody knows what it means. All over the city, word goes round. Angels have stood barefoot on the town hall steps. It's right. They're walking up the edge row two by two. Their heads are shaved. They're all in white. They're walking on thorns. And the owls have flown off the white towers. And they're flying around Millennium Square making wild cries. And the starlings are back. And the Black Prince is riding up Vicar Lane to the Corn Exchange. And thousands are following him and singing all over the city. Word goes round and no one knows what it means. Thank you for listening.